film about? What's it really about? What genre does it hit? What is really being said? What's really being seen? That's what you're talking about.
Hello and welcome back to the Intermission Podcast, a show about pop culture and content. It has been a really long time since our last episode, and you may have wondered if this podcast is heading towards the trash bin of history. Keeping a podcast alive is not mission difficult, Agent Hunt. It is mission impossible. And we are back once again, like the Terminators. It's myself, Nitin Sundar, and I'm once again joined by my good friend. Hello, Dodi.
You can call me the Kentity.
Oh, my goodness. Everything is coming together. Everything is coming together. The Destroyer of Worlds is here on the podcast, the Kentity. To give you a sense of everything that we're going to be talking about today, we're going to be talking about the biggest movies of the summer, Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning Part 1, Oppenheimer, and Barbie. And we're going to call this episode the Barbenheimer. It's been a while, Dodi. How have you been doing?
I'm good. Thank you for that introduction. Like Nitin said, it's been a while since we've come on. I think both of us were traveling a little bit, and then one thing led to another. And I know I've been lazy. I know you've been productive with your other podcast. So I'll squarely pull this on to myself. It's been an odd summer also when it comes to movies. Usually I have a lot more movies. Things are coming out every other week, every week. This summer, even though there've been a few big, big movies, it hasn't really been like pre-COVID summers, right? Where every week you would have something that was reasonably sized. So it's also not been a very busy summer, even though it's had some, let's say, loud points. I wouldn't call them big points yet. We'll figure out as we get through this episode whether these are high points, but they are definitely loud oxygen-sucking points. I'm glad to be back. I did want to talk about these movies, and I think it's important that we dissect them a little bit and talk about what the summer has been like for both of us and for movies in general.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the Barbenheimer hashtag is not yet dead, thanks to us. We've resurrected it after, I don't know, 2 months after it trended bizarrely globally for a really long time and just seemed to collectively capture the imagination of global audience, which is quite strange. We will get into all of that. And of course, Mission Impossible as well. We both of us have a Tom Cruise soft spot, of course. So we will get to that. But before that, I think yesterday, Dodi, you probably watched the biggest movie of the summer. Please tell us about Jailer.
வரலுக்கு மேல நம்ம கிட்ட பேச்சே கிடையாது.
Jailer. Okay, Rajni is back. Yes. I reasonably enjoyed it. Like, it was fine for a movie in the theater with Rajni, whatever else. The first half, actually, I did enjoy. It was pacey and everything else. For me, the second half, once the tone shifted over to this heist movie, and that heist took really long to like come together. There was like a lot going on. It took like a lot of setup. And I also didn't like spoilers for Jailer. I also didn't really like the ending twist around the sun.
I was
trying to, in fact, second guess it, thinking the sun is also pretending to do something just so he can get out of that situation alive. But I don't think that really worked for me. That being said, I did feel that Jailer was probably better than a few of the last few outings that Rajni has had. Darbar, and what's the other one where
Let's not talk about it. Annatha, yes.
Ah, yes. Oh, yeah, yeah. That was horrible. See, from that perspective, well, Jailer, great. but also, yeah, I felt like they missed a few tricks. But we can get to that. Well, what about you? What did you think about Jailer?
Broadly agree with everything that you said. It seemed like a very generic, off-the-shelf kind of hero servicing movie. I think they did a reasonably good job with Rajnikanth in the sense that his age doesn't show through so much in this film. I think the main character he plays is more or less in line with his actual age. Maybe not his actual age, but at least closer to his actual age. So at least he's not romancing young women and doing his usual stuff. I thought there is one flashback sequence where they try their best with makeup and, I don't know, CGI to make Rajnikanth look or pass off as someone in his 30s or 40s, and it absolutely doesn't work. But it was okay. It was all okay. I think a lot of characters, and we should also note that, you know, the concept of the pan-Indian film now means getting some bit of fan service that could work in different parts of the country. Yeah. So you have Shiv Rajkumar, and you have Mohanlal, and you have Jackie Shroff. There's like no end to, and it's not like any of these people have proper characters or proper scenes. They're just there for one or two mass moments. That's pretty much all that is required.
But and I think it works. I think it works. That bit worked, actually. That I really enjoyed, all of them. I mean, it wasn't great, but it works for what they're trying to do.
And this has now become a pan-country phenomenon, right? If you see Jawan is releasing this weekend, you again have Nayantara and Vijay Sethupathi in a Hindi film with Shah Rukh Khan. So the aim is very clear to try and get, you know, more interest amongst audiences from different parts of the country, make the market for the movie bigger. We saw Vikram do this last year as well, where it had, you know, multiple stars come together in the film. This is what it means now to do a pan-Indian film, I guess. For me, what really worked in Jailer, the director Nelson has this extremely quirky sense of humor about him, right? And they call it dark humor in Down South. I don't know if it really qualifies as dark humor. I don't know how to classify it really, but it's a very, very unique signature of his, right? And it was there in his earlier film, Doctor, and Kolamagu Kokila as well.
Okay. Give me an example here in Jailer. Like, what would you say is signature to him?
Well, the example of the henchmen in different disguises, right? Just being a part of the background.
Yes, yes. That I really enjoyed. It's a quiet joke in the background, yes.
Yeah. Or the Bharatiyar lines that Yogi Babu comes up with, which are basically nonsense, but they just fit in so well. And especially because he mashes that up into, you know, extremely violent, extremely grotesque kind of scenes that are playing out in the foreground, right? So, which is just funny. Even the villain seems to have, you know, his own wackiness to him, where he's dripping people into buckets of acid. And his henchmen sort of break into song and dance to a song from Tal, etc. It's very original to Nelson. I don't know if it's high art or anything, but it's just...
No, that's
I think it's a very unique sort of touch that he brings to his films. And I think it adds to his movies. It's something I look forward to. I'll definitely recommend, if you haven't watched it, the film Doctor. It came a couple of years back, Nelson's film. I think it's still his best work. I did not watch Beast, which was also directed by him. It flopped.
Beast was him. Okay.
Yeah. Apparently because it didn't have these touches is what I've heard and read, but I don't know.
You didn't feel the power, terror, fire?
Absolutely. No, absolutely not. But I would highly, strongly recommend Doctor.
Yeah, for me, you know, one is, like you said, this pan-India stuff worked. I really enjoyed Yogi Babu, though I felt that he went a bit missing in the second half.
Yep.
I think he's actually a very good performer also. You know, they use him in these small things. He works correctly there. But he's able to do a little more than just be the sidey guy. There's a chemistry he has, at least with certain actors, which he's able to do with Rajni as well. I feel those car scenes where they're both sitting together and driving, and he's just silently responding to whatever Rajni is doing. Really, really good, you know, apart from the distinct look and the comedy that he adds. One couple of things that I found that really jarred. We spoke about the twist about the son. Even that... I thought, again, in the end, they had to end triumphantly. So not triumphantly, but kind of with him as a hero and walk away. What I was hoping that would then end in, once we decide we're going down the route where the son himself has turned bad, I thought they would then go down the route where he finally lands up again, standing next to, talking to Ramya, saying, yes, it was my honesty that got my son killed. He has to bring it back to make it his fault or his like responsibility or whatever. Something like that. I thought that would be the end, because you have to have... Twice they had that dialogue earlier on, and he says that's the reason, because you pointed that out to me, I've gone on this revenge spree. He's actually not on a revenge spree before that. So I thought that closure will come in the end with him saying, yes, it was me responsible in a roundabout way. I wasn't able to kill the man who was responsible for your son's death or something. That kind of thing didn't come, but I guess that's a very downer ending then, to have him sitting next to Ramya and admitting defeat.
I love how you're looking for logical you know, consistency in this extremely random story plot.
You reject my hypothesis of logic.
I don't. I'm just amused by it. I don't think anybody really cares. Yeah. I remember when Vikram came out a year back, there is this whole thing that, you know, Kamal Haasan lifts stories from outside outside influences, which he does not necessarily credit. Yeah. And somebody pointed out that the story of Vikram is actually the story of Mike Ehrmantraut from Breaking Bad. The flashback of Mike Ehrmantraut, where he has a son who's a cop and, gets killed by the system. And then he goes, the old man comes back and takes revenge, which I found, I found it very amusing. But then I saw Jailer, and Jailer has a very, very similar storyline, except for the ending is different, of course, because the son has actually gone bad here.
Yeah,
you could complete the triumvirate if you add Peter to the mix, which was Rajni's, one of his previous films, where Vijay Sethupathi plays his son. And there is a twist there, a very different sort of twist. This, I thought, of the three father-son sort of relationship arcs that were traced in these three films, this one easily the weakest of the lot. Yeah. The ending absolutely did not work for me. They don't stick the landing. But it was fine at the end of the day.
Partly that guy is not able to... They needed somebody with a bit more presence to be in that role as well. I think that guy didn't fit that. The son didn't really match up. The other thing that jarred for me was... when his final real entry happens in front of the family, when they're all sitting around the table and he tells them to sit down and that entire attack happens on the house.
Yeah.
Which is the interval. You're heading into the intermission point.
Interval block.
Look, you want that scene to be cool. You want that scene to shock his family in some way. But I feel like the framing was entirely around, the family being so distressed at the spraying of blood and all of that. It seemed to be rooted in the fear and this thing of Ramya Krishnan and the daughter-in-law.
Yeah.
Rather than something a bit more cooler or whatever, saying, okay, father-in-law is finally stepping up to take some action. Yeah. This was more of we should be scared of him. I get there's a little bit you want to play that fear up, but I felt the way that was staged, that entire scene, seemed more rooted in their fear than in his awesomeness.
Interesting.
It was a little jarring.
Konjam. இதோட நிறுத்திக்கலாம்ல
ரொம்ப தூரம் போயிட்ட ஃபுல்லா முடிச்சுட்டு தான் திரும்பி வர முடியும்.
It's an interesting point you make, right? The way I would think about that scene is, I think one of the bigger problems with Rajnikanth in the last few years has just been age is really caught up with him. It's very tough to get Rajnikanth to do much more than just merely show up. Which I thought Shankar, for instance, in Endiran and Robot Part 2 used really well, because most of it was CGI. You just had Rajnikanth's face doing
most of the
work. And
also, if you're saying Robot, then the movement automatically is stiff. So it's okay.
It's already stiff as well. Yes. Exactly. Now, when you want a solid interval block, ideally you want someone beating up baddies. You want, acrobatic stunt sequence, some amount of energy in it, right? Aside, Vikram also does this really well, because Kamal Haasan is wearing a mask and it's clearly not Kamal Haasan who's beating up the baddies in that scene. So I thought the fact that they got Rajnikanth to sit down and talk with a lot of interesting close-ups of his face and the reaction, right? You, as they say in a horror film, it's not so much what you see, but when you see the fear in somebody else's eyes that the horror spreads to you as well. So you got that sort of a scene over there where it was, like you said, reflected gore. There's plenty of action happening all around because, I don't know, Jackie Shroff's henchmen or whoever is beating up these people, or Shivraj Kumar's marksmen, whatever, right? So there are people getting shot, killed, axed, and all of that. There's blood splattering all over. It definitely works for the audience, right? And we must also realize that in South India now, it's basically those mass moments. And mass moments basically are close-ups, slow motion scenes, puff of dust as the boot comes down and all of that. I think from that mechanics, in terms of what works for the market, it was a very solid interval scene. And
my point is that it can still work without having to be so rooted in their distress and fear.
Sure, cannot. Yeah.
Well, there's probably a slightly different way to do it. Those are a couple of things that jarred. Otherwise, fine, whatever. I felt like that whole Tamanna storyline with that love story was funny, but also unnecessary. It became too distracting. Like, I was like, where's Rajni? Let's get back to our story. There's a son who's dead, or the son who's now alive. Let's find him, whatever.
Yeah. What I found really funny about the Tamanna sequence, I don't know if this is something, it was some kind of subliminal commentary that the director was putting in there, because there is an entire set of jokes involving wigs. and you have Rajnikanth there
yes.
on screen. Yes. So I really don't know what is that supposed to mean. And yeah. it's not just Rajnikanth, like you have an entire ensemble of wigs in this film. Mm-hmm. Like Mohanlal shows up with, I don't know, a leopard on his head and whatnot, right?
Now, at least Rajni, you know about the wig, right? I mean, like, he owns the baldness. His public persona does not involve a wig. There are other people in that movie and many other movies or actors in general whose public persona also involves a wig, who are publicly not accepting the wigness. So I don't think it's a dig at Rajni, but weakness. It is almost
it's certainly
not. A dig
at Definitely not a dig at Rajni. I mean, it wasn't intended that way either.
Yeah.
But I just found it extremely funny.
Yeah, that's funny. I also felt that, and I don't know enough about the industry, but... I feel like that director and his whatever assistant guy, the guy who's constantly smiling and making noises. Is that a reference to someone? That must be, right? There's too much specificity in that side character of being in a bathtub and always being in that robe. Even in the final scene, he's again back in a robe. Like clearly he's just come out of the bathtub with a shower cap and a robe.
Yeah.
There's some like somebody's in joke happening there. It's too specifically random a thing, I feel.
So the guy who shows up with the shower cap is this actor called Redden Kingsley. You should, again, I'll refer back to Doctor, which is the earlier film from Nelson. And Redden Kingsley has a much longer presence in that film. And he is hilarious, right? Mm-hmm. I think his calling card, and Nelson uses this best, is to put him in extremely unusual circumstances where you would not expect him to be there. And the guy just has a very unique body language and extremely different kind of dialogue delivery and all of that, which just works. I just think it was just Nelson going for complete wackery. I have a question for you. So the person who plays the villain who drops, people into the acid, his name is Vinayakan, right? He's a Malayalam actor who's shown up in this film.
Solid presence, that guy also.
He's really good, right?
Yeah.
Do you know who was originally intended to be cast in that role and even agreed to play the role before he was requested by Rajni and others to actually not play that role? It was originally Rajnikanth's idea to try and get this guy. He's a big name. They asked him and he said yes. Mm-hmm. But later, on second thoughts, they thought probably wouldn't make sense to have him. Do you know who?
No idea whatsoever.
It's Mammootty, apparently.
Ooh.
Yeah, and I can't even imagine Mammootty playing that role, but apparently it was in the plans, or maybe they wrote the role differently after deciding not to have him. I don't know, because Vinayakan ends up playing a bit of a villain with comic flourishes as well, which I really don't see Mammootty playing, but
That would have changed the movie quite a bit.
Completely,
yeah.
Rajnikanth originally wanted a big, as part of the whole Pan India idea, I'm imagining, wanted a big actor to play that role. And even spoke to Mammootty, and Mammootty was ready to play just based on the fact that Rajnikanth was asking him. And then Rajnikanth himself thought, you know what, Mammootty probably is not the right guy for this role. It wouldn't be right to put him in something that looks like this. And he asked him not to come anyway.
Yeah, fair enough. Let me end on this. I thought the interval point, because until then, we still don't know he used to be a jailer, right?
Yeah.
I thought the interval point punch dialogue, I was waiting for it, would be some, because they're attacking his house and turning it into, I also didn't know what the story was. So my assumption was the second half is largely a siege of Airby trying to attack his family and he's fending them off. Because in the trailer, you don't get a sense of anything else.
Yeah.
Like the heist and all is not really there. There's that song, but you don't know where it turns up. Anyway. I was waiting for a line of, they tried to turn my house into a jail for me, but little did they know.
Yo, Abba.
Nanda jailer.
Yo.
Because they don't refer to him as a jailer at all until like second half comes. When they come to the house, I was like, some jailer line is going to come now, but there was nothing anyway. Yeah.
It was very strange, actually, because there is a 10-minute flashback, and I'm really glad it ends fast because Rajnikanth really doesn't look the part for that in that flashback. But I also thought, where is Mohanlal in that flashback, right? And I think it was just, how many people can we actually make, convincingly look young in this flashback? Yeah. And they decided, you know what? And obviously they couldn't get dates or whatever.
But
what exactly was he doing as a jailer? Was he reforming these guys? Because Jackie Shroff is supposedly reformed from being the gunda he is in the jail. And what does he become? He becomes this dynamite country bomb making guy.
Yeah. Who's still providing henchmen to guys like
On demand to his ex-jailer. Same with Shivraj Kumar as well. So I really don't know what they were going for with the whole dealer.
Loosey goosey. He's kind of just enough reform that they respect him and will do anything for him. That's the line of reform that's happened. All right. So that was Jailer, which I think we just about enjoyed. Time pass, okay. I think that's the one word verdict that I'm coming out on. Hukum, Tiger ka hukum.
Yeah, so let's then get into the Hollywood summer, starting with
Mission Impossible: Dead Reckoning Part 1.
The movie is 2 hours and 45 minutes long, and it takes 2 hours just to say the name of
the name.
None of our lives can matter more than this mission.
I don't accept that.
Okay, let me go first. I was super hyped. As you know, I am very happy to get hyped. So, and especially if it's Tom Cruise and it's like stunts, and I really enjoy their production and all of that. So I get super excited. So, you know, I was overly hyped as always. I think a simple way to say it is Maverick paid off on all of that hype.
Yeah.
Mission Impossible: Dead Reckoning Part 1 did not. You know, I did watch it multiple times. I enjoyed all the stunts. Something in the story just didn't add up. And yes, we don't go to these movies for the story, but this story felt more like it could have fit in a Fast and Furious, where you're actively saying, I don't really care if the shit connects as long as there are big action set pieces. Here, there's some expectation that the stuff should connect. And when that doesn't, it's a little disappointing. That's kind of the short version of where I came down on. What's your short version before you get into details?
I think I was a lot more hyped up for this film, mainly because of Top Gun and how good it was. Mm-hmm. And also because the previous Mission Impossible film, which I thought one of the best, I don't know if you remember, we watched it together. One of the many times I'm imagining you would have watched it in yes. Bangalore in the IMAX screen, where there is that helicopter chase that happens in the end, which is one of those sequences that I just keep remembering. And usually when you see these action movies, you tend to forget the set pieces beyond a point in time because you see more of the same in other films and so on, right? But that was one sequence and that was one movie that stayed with me. So I was really looking forward to this also because it's been a long time in the coming, you know, it was hit by the pandemic. And I think Tom Cruise did a lot to try and get cinema back and going, which is all, of course, with the hope that eventually this film will see the light of day post-pandemic. He even went and watched Tenet and made a big deal out of it, if you remember, during the pandemic, because he was trying to say it's safe now to go to cinema halls.
Yeah.
He should have actually sprinted to the Tenet screening. He doesn't do that. You don't see the Tom Cruise run in that video. So I was quite hyped as well going into this film. And I broadly agree with you. I think these plots are getting tiresomely overblown. I think what they were trying to do, what's going on here, it doesn't have to be this complicated. I think the whole thing can be simplified because we all know that that's not what we're coming for. But maybe this being the potential final set of films in this franchise is an overall 5-hour story with part two also in the making. So maybe they just had a lot to cover. Maybe there's a lot more that gets covered in the second part, post which it'll begin to make sense. But I thought from a story point of view, it was quite a drag.
I don't know that it's a complexity of a story because if you try to go back and track even like what they're trying to do in Ghost Protocol with that nuclear bomb, who's getting it, who's giving it to, none of the, even Fallout actually plot-wise makes no sense, right? Why Henry Cavill is kind of helping them, but not. It's about, not about complexity, but it's about confusing and not having like a relatively straight through line from one action scene to another. And they're usually good at fixing those things because if you notice all of those scenes, and they do it in all of the Mission Impossibles, at least since Macquarie has come around, is all of those exposition scenes are all shot much later. They kind of then figure out.
They don't fit in.
Let's figure out. Let's change two lines of dialogue. Let's write all of it and shoot it in one small little room where you don't have to be on set.
People are talking. Yes.
Yeah. Four people in a room, which could very well be in the back lot of a studio, right? That's not on location, whereas everything else is literally on location. So So they do usually have done that very well, which is why I'm a little, like, not a little, quite a bit disappointed at this.
Also, one thing to call out, right? Since we're talking about the plot. So in this film, he's fighting against the entity, which follows in the illustrious footsteps of the apostles.
Yes.
And the syndicate, which are the various other bodies.
Keep having these names.
Yeah. Yep. And it's also extremely fitting that Tom Cruise is at the forefront of the battle against AI in this day of ChatGPT. I think it's only fitting. And
Because he's also making the case for, like, real people doing real stunts, doing real things on screen in real locations, right?
Yes, and is at the forefront of the writer's strike as well, which one of the talking points of the writer's strike is, of course, the impact of AI on cinema.
Yep, and even content. The SAG is striking for the same reason, right? I mean, there was an article recently where Keanu Reeves talks about his contracts have, you cannot manipulate the performance that I've given.
Yeah.
And he's had it for a while, apparently. He says, if you're going to do that, then why do you need me on set, right? So he's
good. But that's only when he's not plugged into the Matrix.
Correct. He's fully digital in and out. Couple of things I wanted to kind of throw light on. See, the stunts still enjoyable. I thought the car chase scene was a lot of fun. And the chemistry inside that car chase scene between Hayley Atwell and him. Hayley is a good addition to the whole thing. She's enjoying herself. Yeah. You know, she's playfully, she's kind of smiling and she's meta commenting on what's happening within the movie. She's like, oh, I'm not a driver. Don't put me on this side of the car. All of that stuff is happening. I thought the other person who was a really bright spot was Vanessa Kirby. In the final switcheroo train sequence, she has to pretend to be Hayley pretending to be her. And I thought that was like a hoot of comedy happening over there.
Yeah. I also thought she played that masked role really well, because you don't feel she's the widow, right, at that stage.
Yes.
Though
yes.
It's the same actor playing it, obviously. Sometimes when we are watching these scenes, we need to remind ourselves it's actually a different person. It's not that person wearing a mask who's playing this.
Yeah.
But I thought Vanessa Kirby really embodies
a great job in that scene.
Really. Yeah.
The other big thing was, and coming back to this only, the disjointedness. They usually write very good motivations for each scene to occur. You know, I think one of the problems I had was in that train sequence, if you remember, at one point that CIA chief Carrie Elwes is giving this whole exposition to our villain Gabriel, right? Yeah. Telling him what the submarine, because the submarine has not been discussed till now, what we saw in the first 5 minutes. That's another thing. That submarine thing also is the first time a movie is starting without a mission.
Yeah.
Starting in some submarine, none of our main people are there. Tom Cruise is not suddenly flying out of something or landing on something or whatever, right? So they took risky departures from the formula. And I think, at least for me, they didn't really pay off.
The submarine sequence, and I think the Filmcast review also speaks about this.
Yeah.
It doesn't really fit in at the start of part one.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it just gives the
Jeff,
viewers,
right? He said it should have been the starting of part two.
It should have been the starting of part
then
two.
Realize
because
happened,
you've now needlessly given a lot of information to the viewers.
Yeah.
And you're not really, there's no payoff from that knowledge in the rest of this film, at least, right? Yeah, okay, so what?
Yeah.
It is at the bottom of the sea, blah, blah. Yeah. And everyone else, like you said, is catching up. And you're like, yeah, get to it sooner. We know about this already. It would have been much nicer.
By the way, the submarine was added later. So that is something that happened. It was absolutely the last thing that they shot. They did not have the money for it. You should hear the story. Tom Cruise being Tom Cruise. So this is mid-pandemic. They've been spending a lot of money. They're doing pandemic shooting in all of these places. So, like, for everything, the set is getting shut down. You're carting a whole 100 people from Venice to wherever else. And they're all in, like, multiple testing, this and that. I'm talking about peak pandemic. So it's super expensive to be doing all of this, spending a lot of money. At some point, Paramount sends their CEO to talk to Tom Cruise. He goes all the way to Europe. Either head of studio or CEO of the company went to talk to Tom Cruise saying, okay, macha, enough. Like, we get it. But also, like, this movie is bleeding. We've hit like 150, 175 million. You need to stop. So he's gone there with the intention of, when can we wrap up and start moving towards post-production and getting the movie out? Tom, being Tom, manages to convince him that we need a submarine scene, so I need another 50 million. That guy's come back, green, having approved another, not 50, some 25 million or something to shoot that submarine scene. He's gone to cut down the budget. He's come back like giving more. That's the power of Tom Cruise Galata. But so that's been added on, and it's very obvious. But and you're right, those guys were right. It should probably be the start of the next movie. But he's explaining all of that, and the movie completely slows down. At that point, the only thing we're seeing is Tom Cruise riding up that mountain, right? Which in theory should be kind of exciting because we know the stunt is coming.
Yes.
But the problem with that scene is,
We know what is coming.
no, one is we know what is coming. The other is he doesn't know what's coming. As a character, he's always driving towards something. That entire scene, he's like, what am I doing? Where am I going? What am I doing? Where am I going? As
We
opposed
all
to,
know. Yeah,
yeah.
exactly.
Even in other places, when he says, I'll figure it out, at least he's, as a character, actively figuring it out.
Yeah.
You know, he's not like a puppet being pushed somewhere. He's moving without motivation. If he said, I'm going up and I'm going to jump off that damn thing because that's the only way to get there, and Simon Pegg is saying, no, are you crazy? That scene would have had some momentum that
Correct.
when it's cross-cutting with this guy doing all this exposition. I felt like that scene completely dropped out. And in fact, to come back to the way they shoot, and we can probably link this trailer, one of the last trailers that came out for the movie has an alternate take of this discussion between Simon Pegg and Tom Cruise, where they've gone for the Simon Pegg joke of saying, look, now what to do? I'm really stressed out. Just jump off the damn thing and land. Like, they wanted to hit
Okay.
that joke. But if you see that cut of it, it's Tom Cruise on the motorcycle saying, okay, fine, let's go to plan B. And Simon Pegg is saying, he's in the car driving and he's like, plan B, what's plan B? And he's frustrated, which is what a normal Mission Impossible movie would be, where Cruise
Yeah.
is figuring it out and the others are there to provide like logistical or whatever else support.
They should have quietly done a cut to Vikram where Kamal Hassan says,
But we don't have a plan B, sir.
Plan B is to make plan A work. Yeah.
Greatest line ever.
Greatest line ever.
I just felt like they were not able to, they lost track of character motivations and all of that. And that, unfortunately, that jumping off the cliff stunt to me doesn't work because it has nothing else other than the stunt part of it.
Yeah, which has been, unfortunately been spoiled by as part of the promos itself. I was
Even
reading.
spoiling it has to have a story, right? Sorry, I'll just finish.
Yeah.
Like if you see the Burj sequence, he's climbing outside, but he's climbing to something, he's climbing back. There's like 10 things happening around the climbing,
You're right.
right?
Yeah.
Even the halo jump from Fallout, through the jump, he's like catching that guy,
There is
changing
plenty
the,
happening in the lead
yeah.
up to it. You're right. Here, there's nothing. He's just
Helicopter
riding a
also, he's
motorbike.
climbing up. He climbs up, he falls
Yes.
down, he climbs up again, he gets in the chopper. Then the chopper flying is another set of things where he's trying to
Yes.
solve a problem while, okay, if I'm in the chopper, how do I get to the other chopper? The only way to do
Yeah.
it is to crash into them. Now, how do I safely do that? Like all
Yeah.
of that is going on. This one is just he jumps and then
That's
he
it.
lands.
Yeah.
There should have been some coverage of I'm too fast to land on this, and that guy's saying, or whatever, that guy's saying it's too fast,
Yeah.
and he's saying, you know, Tom is saying, I'll figure it out, I'll figure it out. You have to hear that I'll figure it out, and the Ethan Hunt
Yes,
is like
you're right.
making this work with by sheer force of will. That's the
Yeah,
character. He's just like, I'll somehow fucking do this.
and there needs to be a proper build-up, right? It can't just be that you rode up a hill and then you jumped off. Like you said, the boot sequence, there's so much happening before the actual jump itself, right? Not all of which was seen by us. But the problem here is not that just that we saw what was going to happen in the trailer, but we also saw it already in Pathan, where Salman Khan jumps and lands inside the train. The whole movie after that is, scene by scene, I think, or inspired by
Pathan train
YRF.
sequence.
Indeed. But who did it better? Jumping through the
Jumping
train. Yeah.
through the train. This, but I did feel that joke works, but the when he lands in through the window and saves her at the last second, the joke
Yeah.
works. But I felt like we lost track of where Ethan Hunt was during that entire
Yeah,
sequence. It was badly done.
absolutely. No, the joke works. The joke is fine. No, my question was, Salman and Shah Rukh obviously point out that, these other guys, these new kids can't
These
do it, so
kids.
it needs to be us. I think they were referring to Tom Cruise as one of those kids who can't do it, which is why they keep doing it. I was reading Anthony Lane's review of this film, as I do for all the films I watch, of The New Yorker, one of the best, my favorite movie reviewers. So he writes about the fact that the motorbike scene was spoiled in trailers, right? And I like the way he's put it. On a larger scale, the main attraction of Dead Reckoning is a motorbike and parachute leap that was previewed, unpacked, and explained online many months ago. The purpose being to demonstrate that Cruise, the nerveless and unfading star, had performed the maneuver himself. Here is a motion picture equipped with auto spoilers, eager to stress that at the heart of its fantasy lies something very risky and real. That sort of captures where we are in this performative age of social media. That's what it's come down to, right? It's not just that we are doing this. Look how we did it. It's become so important that the actual doing of it is okay to take a back seat, right? And
I agree with that point that you're making. For me, the knowing that it was going to happen is not that much of a problem. Even in Fallout, we knew he was going to, even in Burj, we already knew he was going to climb the
Not just that he was going to, but we even know exactly how he is, how he did it, how he's going to do it, because you've got multiple shots. That scene of him jumping off, right, from the bird's eye view of him landing through thin air. You've seen that like hundreds of times already. That's such an awe-inspiring scene. The first time it sees you, it really hits you. Imagine seeing that for the first time.
Unspoiled territory. But
just trailers, right? It's, I mean, you could avoid a trailer, but you can't avoid this. You open Instagram, you're going to see it. You open anything, you open your eyes, you're going to see it, right? Because it's everywhere.
But I would posit this, that if the sequence was proper, what we're talking about having other things in it, it would not matter that we knew it was going to happen. In Fallout, and
my problem wasn't so much that I knew it was going to happen. My problem was that I've seen this already. I've literally seen this
scene also.
Picture, and it's something that's so awe-inspiring. And you said, it needs to have more to it before, after, something. Mm-hmm. And it's okay if you've just shown me like 5 seconds of that moment in a trailer. Right? Yeah. That piques my interest. Here you've shown me everything. And I've seen it too many times. But you're right. Fair enough. The anticipation also falls flat. You're right about that as well.
Yeah. Okay, so that was Mission Impossible. We wanted to like it more than we did, but unfortunately it wasn't. But yeah, like you said, I think looking forward to part two. McQuarrie does talk about, they had written one movie and it was a bit too long. And then they said, okay, fine, let's turn it into two. And I think what happened in that turning it into two is that they cut the half point in such a way that they had to fill in more masala in part one. I'm sure part two also might have. Maybe they've kept more interesting stuff in part two. Let's see. But yeah, it didn't do the part one, part two properly either. You know, it ends on a slightly...
It's very abrupt. Yeah.
Yeah.
The submarine sequence would have been the perfect ending for this film as well, by the way. It would have been a nice way to cue in what's going to happen in part two, because you also want to say, hey, now there's water to look forward to. You've seen the mountains in this part of the film. It was just a very, very bad edit.
Yeah. Last thing I'll say is poor guy also got stuck with really, it's one of the, it didn't perform anywhere as close as they would have liked. I wouldn't say it's bad, but I think he also got screwed because of release timing. He only got the spot 1 week before Barbenheimer. And nobody could have guessed that Barbenheimer would become that much of a phenomenon. And that's kind of screwed him. He might have been better off coming out now. And then because of the strike, not having any more movies running after him, that would have kept it going. But yeah, that was just... I mean, you have to get marketing and all of that. So if the actors can't speak now and you don't have Tom Cruise standing everywhere taking photos, you don't get the kind of marketing push that you need. So that brings us to the event of the summer, the Barbenheimer phenomenon.
So Barbenheimer phenomenon, but I would like to reiterate, the name of this podcast episode is Barbenheimer Jailer.
yes, let's add.
Now that we've gotten two of those out of the way, let's move on to Oppenheimer.
We're in a race against the Nazis. And I know what it means. If the Nazis have a bomb.
We have a 12-month head start.
18.
How could you possibly know that?
We've got one hope.
All America's industrial might and scientific innovation connected here.
A secret laboratory.
Keep everyone there until it's done.
Let's go recruit some scientists.
Build a town, build it fast. If we don't let scientists bring their families, we'll never get the best.
Oppenheimer, why don't you go? I went first the last couple of times.
I was in Dubai, actually the week before Oppenheimer released, right? And it is one of the movies that I've been looking forward to for quite a while because it's Nolan, and I was expecting Nolan ode to science and time and whatnot, right? Taking on from Inception and Interstellar, that's sort of what I was looking forward to. And I was checking show timings for Oppenheimer to see if I could catch it before I went to India in IMAX, etc. And I suddenly noticed that Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning is already running in Dubai. And this is before it released anywhere else in the world. It released in the United Arab Emirates a week earlier. Because of the the Abu Dhabi connection. And I was like, wait, this movie was not supposed to come this week. So that's how I ended up watching Mission Impossible, I'm not going to repeat the full name of the movie one more time. But eventually, I was in India by the time Oppenheimer released. I couldn't catch it in Dubai. So, and I was very particular that I wanted to watch this in IMAX the first time. So I think we spent like a couple of weeks, or maybe 3 weeks, trying to find a show to go to, right? And there aren't so many IMAX things.
Come back to the thing that you said about the first time. because that word will now become moot, but go ahead.
Yes, I didn't know at that point that I would only be watching it once.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
So I kept waiting and waiting, and eventually didn't get a show, didn't get a ticket because the show's running full, which is, I think, where I want to point out the hubris that Tom Cruise and team probably had. I don't think they realized how big this phenomenon was going to be.
Yeah.
Because even without Barbie to prop it up, and Barbie didn't really do all that well in India, Oppenheimer was going to be a huge hit in some of the global markets. And I don't think the Mission Impossible team realized that. If they'd seen the trend line of what Nolan's films have been doing, they would have been a little more circumspect about the release date, I would imagine.
See, IMAX and Nolan have a strong relationship. So they had already committed. He was in the last few weeks of pre-release to Mission Impossible. Tom was fighting with IMAX saying, give me more screens. Even after one week or 2 weeks, give it back. And they said, nothing doing.
Yes.
He's our guy. He uses our cameras. We work with him.
Exactly. And people want to watch
and he
it.
He committed years ago to this date. You're like moved around for pandemic. That's the mistake also. He's come in and jumped in on other people's spaces.
That, you fix a date to drop a bomb, there's no changing.
Correct.
Right. So eventually managed to get tickets to watch this on a Monday morning in Bangalore, a 6:50 a.m. show. It's the earliest I've ever been to a cinema hall. I've never been to one of those 2 a.m., 3 a.m. Rajini releases, etc. Must say, firstly, that it's 6:50 a.m. is a great time to watch a movie because, you do end up waking up early, but you've beaten the traffic. And let's also say, as you head into your late 30s, early 40s, staying awake through a film becomes a huge challenge. And it's something that I really am struggling with now.
Yeah.
Oppenheimer.
Especially 3 hour films like we have nowadays.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oppenheimer, despite being such a talky film, despite me watching it at 6:50 a.m. in the morning, I was fully plugged in. There was not a single moment, a single nuance in that film that I missed.
Yeah.
It totally absorbed every single molecule that the film had to offer. Anyway, so that's about the experience of watching Oppenheimer. My initial thoughts on the movie, I know that people have said, there are many ways in which you can use the IMAX camera. It need not be necessarily to show you, big action set pieces. It can show you emotions. It can show you, features and reactions, etc. far better and all of that. But when I saw the film, I did feel a bit let down because it wasn't, especially after having waited all this time to watch it in IMAX, I thought it didn't quite deliver the IMAX bang for buck that, a Dunkirk or any of Nolan's recent films have been consistently delivering. I thought the movie was fine. It takes a certain point of view. There's a story that Nolan wants to say about Robert Oppenheimer and his role in history and how he was racked by the guilt of being at the center of the bomb project, what it meant for him. And I think he went ahead and said that story. It might not be the entire history. Lots of people saying that, he's clearly taking sides and, it's everything is not what it seems like and all of that. But I thought all that was fine. I think there was a story that he wanted to say. And he said it in typical Nolan fashion with, a lot and lots of dialogue. I think the exposition in this film is it's made easier by the fact that a lot of it is actually very talky. There are these court marshalling and hearings that are going on, which and he repeats the same thing, I think, multiple times in this film, which is just Nolan's way of doing things. There are female characters that are so poorly written. If it weren't Nolan, you'd think it were a joke. I think Florence Pugh completely wasted.
And you watched it in India, so half her footage is not there as well. So.
Also, the most interesting parts of the film were blocked out as well, unfortunately. Not chopped off, painted over. They painted her like one of the CBFC's French models. I thought overall, the fact that there was no CGI used for the bomb and for, all the other things, this film tries to show a lot of the internal turmoil that Oppenheimer went through, his visions that he gets something big happening
the
or whatever.
Molecules
molecules and explosions or whatnot. All of that was apparently accomplished without CGI, which is, it's appreciable without necessarily being awe-inspiring for me. I thought I was appreciating the fact that CGI was not used more than actually appreciating the scene itself. And for me, that then is a problem. I thought the build-up to the bomb sequence was really good. I think it really did convey the tension in that area, despite the fact that we know how history panned out. I thought that 20-25 minute sequence leading up to the bomb blast and the bomb blast itself, the way it sort of absorbed and experienced by the people there with, the sunglasses and sunscreen and all of that, I thought was really well done. I know a lot of people complain about the last 40 minutes out of the film, which goes into you know, it just becomes a very talky, it almost becomes a whodunit about what happened later. I quite enjoyed that as well. And I'll probably attribute that to this being a 6:50 a.m. show. I wasn't yet falling asleep. So, I thought it was a really solid performance from Robert Downey Jr. as Louis Strauss. A little bit of the exposition really got to me there, because number of times they go back and refer to that one moment where there was a perceived slight. Even if you did not know any of the history of what exactly happened, you would still pick up somewhere, probably, you know, a third of the way into the movie, you'd probably pick up onto the fact that Louis Strauss is probably the guy who's going to screw over Robert Oppenheimer. And that definitely happened to me, because I didn't know the history. And I remember telling my wife, you know, this guy is the bad guy. Watch out. But overall, not the greatest Nolan film I've seen by a stretch. A bit of a disappointment, because I was expecting something that would move me as much as Inception and Interstellar would. And I must say that this film did not.
For me, mostly echo a lot of what you're saying. I think for a change this time, we've had a lot of agreement on this pod. Not that we're...
I think it will change by the time we get to the next
It will change. I know. That's why I left that for the last. It felt pointless eventually. I was like, okay, sure. But like, why do I care? And why am I here watching this? And why is this a Nolan movie? And why is this like... such a big deal or whatever. Suppose why is it like at this scale or whatever else? Coming to the IMAX of it, it's the first time IMAX has been used for acting performances. Like it's a fully acting, talking, and you know, you're getting. And I've seen interviews of Cillian Murphy talking about being shown footage before. Like Nolan did tests with him and showed him, look, this is what it looks like. You need to modulate and act even lesser than normal. Right, because everything is projecting so much. As it is, movie screens are big. But that within that, when you go to IMAX, it's really projecting even higher. So Cillian talks about how it was interesting to have to modulate his acting even further down to more subtle things and things like that. And he's good. Everybody's acted well. Like you said, Robert Downey Jr. is great. Women roles are totally pointless. But at the same time, at least he's cast like Florence Pugh and Emily Blunt. So they are, through sheer force of will, they are making it something. But yeah, again, those roles written-wise, they're lacking. Experiment-wise, sure, interesting, but does it need to be like a Nolan movie experiment and whatever? At the same time...
Well, somebody has to experiment with IMAX. There are like three people who are willing to. So
So good that they're doing it. But yeah, fully appreciate what he's done in terms of, look, it's an R-rated movie. It's 3 hours long. And with that kind of, and it's not got any of his usual, it's got many of his usual things, but it doesn't have the scale and action and all of that, right? Even the bomb is, even though it's at that scale, it's one event and it's potentially the movie can work even without the bomb, frankly. Like the point of the movie is such that actually the bomb is not required. If you just cut the bomb out, the movie still makes the same point that it's trying to make about everything being bad, right? So with all of that and with the standard expectation that you'll have Nolan bros who want to go and like, who think that Nolan movies are the greatest thing ever and all of that, you have that set of people. For all of that to have made the kind of money it's making and to still be running houseful in IMAXs and whatever else, I think super achievement. Like that's really cool. I would have watched this as a regular movie that did not have either IMAX or a Nolan attached to it. But kudos to Nolan for stepping out of his comfort zone also. Trying to do something a little different. I did feel at some points it was more confusing than interesting, where, you know, the flip-flopping was not like getting me anywhere. And even the editing, it's again that there's no need for this edit to be like this. On the one hand, it is...
It could have been a fully job linear of
editing.
Film. Yeah.
From the technical perspective, it's great editing, and I would not be surprised if this person won. I forget the name of the person, somebody new he's working with. While that's a great job, I don't see the why it has to be like this. Like Inception has to be the way it is. Dunkirk pushes the logic, but okay, I can see some logic of showing telescoping timelines, fine. Here I don't see any reason. This is just Nolan saying everybody comes and expects some editing galata in my movies, so let me do something. Like it's a pointless reason to move back and forth. So again, the question is why? Not complaining about the final result, but I don't see the point of why it had to be edited the way it is.
You know, like you mentioned, there's a lot of time jumps in this film, which don't really add much to it, because very often you're just jumping from Los Alamos into, you know, one of these rooms where the trials are underway, and there's one trial in black and white.
Yeah,
two trials. And also, I must, as an aside, I remember seeing a few people on Twitter going gaga over the fact that the second trial, the one that involves Lewis Strauss, was shot in black and white.
Yeah, black and white colors.
Which, you know, generally you use it for, you use black and white for something that happened in the past and colors for the future. I must say that back in 1999, in the film Hey Ram, the scenes in present-day India are shot in black and white, while everything from the past, from pre-independence, etc., are shot in color. So it's not necessarily novel. And there it actually was making a point as well. It wasn't, you know, randomly just changing the color palette without a real reason
here. Here he's making some point that the not to take...
The world has lost its color.
His thing is that everything before is Oppenheimer's perspective. So it's visible in color. Whereas everything after, he's not there for those scenes. So it's in black and white. It's objective, whereas the first bit is subjective. It's subjectively in color. The next is objective. It's fact of what happened, and it's dialogue from the thing. But I do want to come back to what
you Oppenheimer'd my eyes. Yeah.
But yes, coming back to what you said about Hera, this is bringing us to our overall overarching thesis of this podcast. I think everybody is inspired by Kamal Haasan is the answer. From Quentin Tarantino to... Christopher Nolan.
To Tom Cruise, boss, remaking Top Gun after 36 years, just to keep pace with Tom Cruise, as we have pointed out, was also inspired by Salman Khan.
Correct. Let's be clear. So only Kamal Haasan is the true origin of everything. He's the big...
Look at Jailer, boss. The story is straight lift of Vikram. Just change the ending. Even Rajinikanth is inspired by Kamal. But the one loop back in time that really makes sense is, of course, the most primary one, which is the conversation between Albert Einstein and Robert Oppenheimer by the pond, right? And I think the broad point that Nolan is trying to make in this film, and something that he's alluded to, I would say, multiple times in his past movies, is that in the world, there are people of science and there are the small-minded people, right?
Yeah.
And this whole film, the conceit of this film is ultimately boils down to Lewis Strauss, played by Robert Downey Jr., having this perceived slight in his mind, right? Where he believes that Oppenheimer turned Einstein and the entire scientific community against him. And he keeps going back to this moment where Albert Einstein walks past him and does not react to him, right? Which happens right at the start of the film. We go back to that very scene right at the end. And I thought the way it closes is very strong, because these two men of science are not at all talking about, you know, this administrator, Lewis Strauss, but they're talking about humanity and science, because the conversation they're having is about the chain reaction of the atom bomb, which potentially could destroy the world. And I think we just did, which is the last line. For me, the one scene in this film which gave me goosebumps was that scene. And generally, Nolan films give me a lot of goosebumps. This one had just one. And I think it was the way the film ended.
Nicely done. Agree on that. Even for me, it was the last scene that worked. The last thing I'll say is just, it was also interesting to see a lot of interesting faces peppering around, because all of these scientists are supposed to be famous people within their own right, except that we won't know the names. And as you start running through so many of them in so many scenes, it's difficult to keep track. So, you know, casting relatively recognizable names, your Josh Hartnett's and all of these guys in these kind of roles, I think it was also for me very fun to keep recognizing people and say, oh, it's that guy. Hey, it's this guy. Oh, Matt Damon has turned up. This fellow has turned up. It's all sorts of fun happening in those scenes as well. That was Oppenheimer. Do you have anything else to add before we move on to...
Just one thought. So there is the scene at the end of the trial where RDJ walks out of the trial, right? He's obviously and lots of cameras popping, etc. It would have been great if he just come out and said...
Truth is, I am Iron Man.
I am Iron Man.
Iron Man.
That would have been the mashup we all wanted to see, but did not see. Did you also see that, you know, I think it showed up on social media. They said, Albert Einstein will be back in part two of the Office. Love it. So generally when films release in the South, right? So on day one, day two, you have these press people go with a mic and they stand outside the cinema hall as people are coming out. Having watched movies, they generally do it for Rajni films and, you know, all these big films. And people come out and say, it's a tarri maas macha, like, samma, samma, paisa vasool, super, rendadra, noordra paakla, noordna guarantee, 50 kodi, 100 kodi. So they won't do this for Oppenheimer, and the people are coming out. They've all gone in expecting, you know, big extravagant bombs bursting and all of that. Romba pesranga, bro. Pesikite irukanga, bro. Avlo characters ella theviye illa. Thevillama pesranga, bro. We should put that clip. I think the best. Funniest piece of content around Oppenheimer for me was that.
ஒன்னே முக்காவனா நான் தூங்கினா ப்ரோ, செகண்ட் ஆஃப் பப்ஜி கேம் விளையாடினா ப்ரோ. ஹைப் கொடுத்தாங்க, பாம் வந்து உங்க பக்கத்துல வெடிக்கிற மாதிரி இருக்கும், நீங்க கேர்ஃபுல்லா இருக்கணும் அப்படின்னாங்க. இந்த அளவுக்கு இல்ல, அதுல ஒரு 50 தான் இருந்துச்சு.
ஐசோடோப் எல்லாம் வருது, நியூக்ளியர் ஃபிஷன், அட்டாமிக் ஃபிஷன்.
தெரியுமா ப்ரோ?
அதான் தெரியாது, விக்கிபீடியால நான் சர்ச் பண்ண ஆரம்பிச்சிட்டேன்.
சரவண பவன்ல போயிட்டு பிரியாணி தாடானா அது யார் தப்பு, நம்ம தப்பு. நம்ம மைண்ட் செட் அதுக்கு மாதிரி ப்ரிப்பேர் பண்ணிட்டு வந்துடும்.
ரொம்ப தூங்கிட்டேன் ப்ரோ, பேசிட்டே இருக்காங்க, உண்மை புரியல, தூங்கிட்டேன் ப்ரோ, பார்க்கவே முடியல. ரொம்ப தயவு செஞ்சு யாரும் வந்துடாதீங்க, முடியல, 3 மணி நேரம் உட்காரவே முடியல. ரொம்ப போர் படம் ப்ரோ, ஒரே ஒரு டைம் தான் பாம்பு போற, பேசிக்கிட்டே இருக்கானுங்க ப்ரோ, முடியல ப்ரோ, படம் தயவு செஞ்சு யாரும்
வராதிங்க. But everybody in Tamil Nadu now is a bro, man. Like, yeah, it's just something else.
I was watching the bits of this, that Jawan audio launch or whatever, some big event happened, you know, last week.
Yeah, yeah.
And they had that whole performance and everything. One of those, your usual Chennai audio launches, it's happened in some stadium with whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And the number of times Anirudh, I saw Anirudh's speech, Anirudh saying, Shahrukh bro was very nice, Shahrukh bro was helpful. Ati bro, I'm always here for your vision. Bro, that bro, piece of bro.
Seriously, well. On a separate side note, Shahrukh Khan in that audio launch also looked at the director, Atlee's wife, who also is the producer of the film, and said,
Priya, you I'll thank later. We'll produce another child. I mean, you and Atlee, not me. Now,
Atlee
and me can co-produce also. There's no problem. We are friends now.
I don't know if you saw that.
What is this?
I don't know where he was going with it. Clearly high.
Sometimes, yeah, SRK, sometimes he starts talking and then he digs himself instead of stepping out. He continues to dig sometimes. He thinks he's being smarter. Okay.
Moving on to the next film in the Broppenheimer Jailer episode of The Intermission. Yes.
Barbie.
When my heart breaks,
some things have been happening that might be related.
When my world shakes,
cold shower,
ooh,
falling off my roof, and my heels are on the ground. What do I have to do?
You have to go to the real world. You can go back to your regular life, or you can know the truth about the universe. The choice is now yours.
The first one, the high heel.
You have to want to know, okay? Do it again.
I'm coming with you.
Okay.
Let me start.
You better start.
So here's the thing. I've been super excited about Barbie for a long time. More than that, I'm just always super excited about anything that Greta Gerwig does, right? So that's the starting point. Greta Gerwig sneezes, I'm like, please let me be there. Let me like wipe this and keep this DNA forever. I'm like that level. God. Okay. So I'm there. So I've been waiting for a very, very long time. Listeners, you should know that I've been trying to convince Nitin to watch this movie for the longest time. Like, before it came out, I was like, watch, be ready. We're going to talk about it, this and that. And Nitin is always lukewarm. Lukewarm is, I think, an understatement. He was just not interested in this IP cash grab and all of that. And at one point, he messages me saying, look, I'm not going to watch it unless there's some massive word of mouth. And we'll post this. There should be a way to put this on our Twitter account, I guess. I sent him this reworking of the Breaking Bad Heisenberg scene. I am the one who knocks. I am the massive word of mouth.
I am the massive word of mouth.
And finally, dear listeners, he has only watched Barbie now in the last week in anticipation of doing this episode.
Yesterday.
So, like a little... okay, fresh. You watched it. Right. So first of all, yeah, thank you for watching it. But yeah, so let me take the lead on Barbie. Greta Gerwig is a god. Let's start over there. That's where my initial interest starts for anything related to Barbie. I don't really have a history with Barbie as a product or anything else. Yeah, let me just first talk about my immediate reactions on the movie. Apart from all the hype that I went in with and the excitement, I thought it was very effective. I had major problems with the tone. You know, it kind of jumps in and out from fun to serious to, farce to many different things. It just keeps changing tone a whole lot. And I felt like that could have been better done in the writing. But in terms of the big messages of the movie, given that this is a large scale production, you're talking about something like Barbie, which has an existing kind of relationship with the audience, and you're working at that scale, these ideas might be too broad. Even the feminist ideas that she wants to put in might be too broad, but they can only fit in like this in a place like this. I do think it's her, Lady Bird and Little Women, the previous two directorial efforts by Greta, were both much cleaner and better in terms of, not better, and more nuanced in terms of what they were trying to say. Barbie is a lot broader, but that's the nature of what that Barbie phenomenon is, or not even the movie. I'm talking about the product itself and the fact that it has an existing thing. So I didn't expect a lot of nuance going in. But those broad messages, they work. And those broad messages do need to be seen by a larger audience, even if I feel like I'm beyond that large, the broad message of, yes, women should have a voice and all of that. I think the world still needs to see it. And I think for that, this movie works. Just to let you know, my last 30 minutes, I went in with my wife and watched this movie. The last 30 minutes, we were both just weeping, like downright weeping throughout the last 30 minutes. Movie got over, we were sitting in shock. We finally went and like decided to have dinner. And at dinner also, we were just like completely drained and don't know what's happening. So at that level, we were affected. I'll give you more stories about my watching the movie, but wow, that's where I am. I do feel like the tone could have been much better done in terms of jumping back and forth between the comedy and the seriousness and all of that. Margot Robbie was super great. I want to talk a little bit more about her, but I'll let you give your input and then we can continue more. Go ahead, Nitin.
Okay. Knowing that you were so moved by the movie, now I probably should rein myself in a little bit. I don't know.
Go ahead. It's fine.
This movie just brings out the cynic in me. Like, I can't even explain how, right? Mm-hmm. Upfront, let me say, you can be a critique of patriarchy, and it's something that we all see and experience all the time. And as men, I think we also exploit it in certain ways because it suits us so. And it's, you can be aware of it and against it and all of that and not like this film as well. So I want to put that out there. And unfortunately, social media discourse nowadays has become that, you know, it's become as unnuanced as saying, oh, you don't like Barbie, you won't go and watch Barbie. Oh, that's because you're pro-patriarchy or whatever. I think that's completely bullshit. This is a certain take on the patriarchy conversation. And like you said, not so subtle, not so tonally well done, etc. as well. It's the film is trying to make a few points, right? We get that. And I think the fact that Mattel has gone out and you know, taken a wild swing with its own IP, with its own brand name, obviously with self-serving interests in mind, and we can keep that aside for a moment, and it's obviously also paid off really well, which also we can keep aside for a moment. I think all of that is to be appreciated. The fact that in this day and age, where I even saw the Mario Brothers movie that came a few months back, and that's an example of how not to do, you know, IP cash grab, I would say, because that film doesn't take a chance at all. It pretty much just puts their products and, you know, brand and titles out there, and it's there to elicit a laugh. Here they've actually gone out on a limb, and I think they reckon with the toxicity of their brand and what Barbie has stood for over the years, which I think is commendable, appreciable. The CEO of the company is, again, you know, it's almost a nudge, wink, wink joke at themselves and at patriarchy. I think all of that is to be appreciated, right? And I wouldn't be cynical about that and say, you know, that's just Mattel doing what they need to do in order to make money. No, I think it's more than that. But all of that said, and all of that aside, watching this film felt like I was watching a Pixar movie that was not animated and did not have the laughs. I think, and there are some Pixar movies that absolutely land, right? They land they land really, really deep themes really well. Mm-hmm. Again, Pixar has also gone through a bit of a journey, right? So I'm talking about movies like Ice Age, Finding Nemo, right? For instance, is such a deep, such a wonderfully said story, I would say. I felt this
Ice Age,
this film,
not Pixar. Note to the listeners. Huh? Go ahead.
Oh, Ice Age is not Pixar. I didn't know that. Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
Interesting. Okay, cool. But all of those films, right? Mm-hmm. when I was seeing this film, it felt like they've obviously taken a very, very deep theme. And it's not to trivialize the theme of patriarchy and feminism to say that it would have fit in really well in a Pixar film if done right.
Yeah.
Right. This film felt like it would have fit much better there. And if it had done that and it had tried to take itself a little less self-seriously, it would have been easier to overlook the flaws in this film, for me, at least, right? And the other galling absence of moments that actually made me laugh was something that really bothered me a lot with this film, because it had a lot of scope for that. By and large, there wasn't much of that. And that again, is fine. It's a creative choice that you make. A lot has been said about the production design and all of that, right? Which obviously tries to recreate the Barbie world, which didn't work for me, unfortunately, again. It again drew a blank. The fact that the water is fake and there is the scene where Ryan Gosling tries to run and jump into the water and he bounces off and all of that. I thought that, again, would have fit in much better in the world of animation. Like, you know, the Lego movie, for instance, might have done a better job of certain things like that. I can see, though, why they decided not to animate this film, why this could not have been animation, is also because there is a journey from the Barbie world into the real world, and you want to show that stark contrast, and not just visually, but also using that visual contrast to cue in the difference in the way these two worlds fundamentally operate. The film is trying to say that Barbie land is, you know, feminine first, real world is patriarchy first, and that's the dichotomy it's going for. But I have a problem fundamentally with the feminine world, which again is utopia, right? This was a world that was created specifically for this film. It's not really a comment on what Barbie itself is. Their interpretation of this feminist first world was not all that interesting. It's different, but it's not particularly interesting. Yes, the men are subservient over there. The women are perfect and they're having everything go down their way. But why are they still wearing heels? If they are living in a perfect world, why are they wearing heels? Right? For instance, why are they floating down? I found a lot of these logical
inconsistencies. There's a point at which it struggles to get to the end what exactly point of what it's saying.
That's really messy. And it would have been okay if the film was not trying to take itself so self-seriously. And I don't mean this as the film was not trying to preach to itself, but I think the way people have gathered around the Barbie movement in the last few months, it almost feels like, you know, you need to imbibe something and learn something from this film. And I'm like, hey, the textbook has printing mistakes, right?
Yeah.
That's broadly the feeling I came with. I don't know if that's a comment on the film itself, but on the way in which the film is perceived. For instance, another simple example, right? There's obviously representation in the Barbie world. You see a couple of differentially abled Barbies, couple of plus size Barbies, and so on. But suddenly cellulite emerges as a potential glitch in the matrix as well. So how do both of these sort of coexist? Like, what are you trying to say? Why is your world not consistent in the worldview you're trying to give? So all of that got to me a bit. I found a little bit of the slapstickery of life within the Barbie world a little jarring beyond a point as well. There's this one sequence which I really loved, right? And I think the way I'm talking about this, it definitely makes me look like, you know, I'm very, very pro-patriarchy. But my favorite scene in that film is the scene where Ryan Gosling experiences patriarchy for the first time. And is, you know, enjoys seeing the horses. He sees the people coming out of the gym, giving him a smile and all of that, which I thought was a really, really great sequence. As a montage, it was so good. I thought the film lacked in those sorts of sequences for me. At least they just didn't do enough for me. You have this teenage girl who shows up, which is like the quintessential stereotypical take on, you know, this teenage girl going through existential angst. You know, the words she uses in that one monologue that she pouts at Barbie when she meets her, woke, fascist, sexualized, capitalism. It is exactly how teenagers of this generation behave, right? They throw out a lot of words and try to act like they're part of a certain tribe without necessarily understanding or meaning to understand what they're saying. And at many points in this film, especially in the mother-daughter relationship between America Ferrera, who plays the mother and the daughter, I was reminded of Everything Everywhere All at Once, which does 100 times better job of capturing teenage angst. So for me, it's all of this, right? It's about the extremely ham-fisted way in which you say big cars masculine, small cars feminine. I mean, who said so? It's all of those things, right? Why did all the other Barbies, after Ken comes back with his newfound philosophy, why did all the other Barbies play along, right? It was barely, a couple of days after they came? Why are they suddenly serving him drinks and all of that? How did the world change so fast? I don't know where reality ends and where make-believe begins in this film. I think as an experiment, as a film which did not market itself to be everything that it was, or did not get marketed to be everything that it potentially stood for, mm-hmm. this film might have been fine. But knowing all the commentary around the film and then watching it so late in the game, yeah. I just felt like extremely irritated at the end of it.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
I don't have anything to say about each of your specific points. Almost all of them I kind of agree with also. Like I said, it is messy and there are things where they don't take the logic fully through, which probably they can't also. So they have to paper over and jump forward. There are certain situations where if you have to say, yes, this is a feminist utopia, but the heel's already there. So fine, you have to make it work that way. Like some things you are kind of hamstrung by what exists within the world. So that's kind of bound to happen. But I have discounted that in favor of the larger thing that's happening within the movie. It's a ham-fisted big idea.
Yeah.
But I think that big idea is required. See, Everything Everywhere All at Once, like you brought up. And I would say even Little Women or Lady Bird are much, much more nuanced and much better at like really getting to a root of a problem or whatever else. But those things can only happen at those scale, at that scale. And here you can only do it big. You could still do it better than this. So I wouldn't say this is perfect. Even at this scale, there are movies that have done a cleaner job of things. Not more nuanced, but cleaner at least. Here, I think the cleanliness also is gone because you have an existing Barbie, set of rules or the way that world has already worked that you're now struggling to fit in logic on both sides. And so it feels like sometimes there's some contradiction coming up and you just try to skip over it and move on and say, let's not bump on that too much. You know, so those issues are there. Some of the pluses I want to talk about, I thought Margot Robbie was outstanding.
Yeah.
Like you can really see plastic becoming human in her performance, right? From the beginning, the way she smiles in the beginning versus the way she smiles in the end is so different. Like there's nothing in the eyes in the beginning. It's all there in the end. The way she changes is simply outstanding. And kudos to Margot Robbie also for producing this movie. She made it happen, basically. She is fast becoming a person I really want to watch. I've always enjoyed her, but it's only now that I'm also paying attention to some of the other things that she's doing. Like she has this production company called Lucky Chap, which did this and which also did Promising Young Woman last year. They did 2 years ago. They did the Harley Quinn movies as well. So she's starting to make things that she's interested in and giving opportunities to filmmakers and throwing money behind ideas that may otherwise not have gotten made. So I think that's an interesting thing that she's doing. And now she's thankfully, fortunately gotten a huge payday out of Barbie doing so well. This is the other thing. Barbie should not, just like Oppenheimer, should not have done that business for an R-rated 3-hour movie. It's like mathematically people say generally should not be possible. It's that kind of like any box office analyst who would be looking at Oppenheimer's numbers or Barbie numbers, these should not reach these kind of phenomena. Now it's the biggest thing of the summer. It's going to cross, I think 1.45 is Harry Potter. So it's going to cross Harry Potter, or it has already crossed, I can't remember, but it should not be at that scale. So it's resonating in some way with people across everywhere. And even if you and I feel like we want the more nuanced version of Everything Everywhere, which is true, I want the Little Women over this. I still think this has its place and it works for the thing that it's trying to do. Coming to Greta, Greta's also she's only made small movies until now. This is the first quote unquote big movie that she's made, but she's done it with a vision, this idea of, I know you said the production design didn't work for you. For me, it worked great. Either way.
Yeah, but that's just a matter of taste, really. Yeah,
but to be able to take that swing at that scale, she's got some ideas and she wants to do something. Usually when it comes to actors, directors like this, you have this one for me, one for them kind of idea where I'll do one big movie, then I'll do one small movie that I can do to satisfy my creative urges, and then I'll make money off the big movie next one. There's this idea of going back and forth. She has been clear through the Barbie press cycle that she wants to do big movies with broad ideas. She's making her thesis statement saying, this is how I want to continue to do stuff. She's taking on Chronicles of Narnia after this. I don't know if it happened or not. It's only in attachment stage. But she is talking about not coming back, at least at this point, not really coming back to smaller movies. She wants to make big movies. She wants to make big statements. I think that would be very interesting to see, to have somebody like a Greta. Again, you can't name many people, right? You have Nolan, you have your few big...
Ryan Coogler.
Coogler. You have a few big people who get, command these 150, 200 budgets, or it's really the IP that's commanding the budget.
Yeah.
Right. Here, finally, hopefully she'll get... I don't think she'll get another 150 again unless it's Chronicles or something. But at least she'll be able to pull a 50 to 100 million on her own, which is huge for women directors as well. And if she's going to keep shoehorning her ideas in like this, I think it... I used the wrong word. I said shoehorn. But if she's going to keep smuggling her ideas in like this, I think it's a plus all said and done. I think we need these movies all said and done. Even if we are... We feel... Personally, we are ahead of it. I feel I am ahead of that curve in some sense, or at least people at our stage and our level of education and awareness and all that might be ahead of the curve on that. The majority of people are not. And I think it's being borne out by the box office and everything else. Another fun thing I wanted to say, so like I was telling you, I'm a huge Greta fan. My wife's already irritated with me that I'm like getting excited over every song release. Songs are great, by the way. I don't know if you've been listening to soundtracks, super songs. So we go to the theater. Everybody's wearing pink. I'm wearing pink. I try to convince her to wear pink and she refused. But anyway, we're all at the theater. She's looking left and she's like, okay, fine. Everybody's like overexcited about this. Let's... I'm in as well. She was there to watch. So it's fine. Credits start rolling. And I'm already kind of cheering. And, you know, Greta Gerwig's name hasn't come up yet. And the first reference is an NB/GG production, which is their production house name. And so my wife said, oh, Greta. And I've already started cheering at that point. Hey, Greta, even though her name has not come, just Gigi. And my wife turns to me and she says, what's this NB? And I turn to her. You know where this is going. I turn to her and I'm smiling because I've been screaming Greta and whatever else. I turn to her and I straight point to myself and I'm smiling. NB, of course, is Noah Baumbach. But yeah, anyway, my wife was like, the moment I did that, she was like, oh my God, why am I stuck with this idiot? Somebody kill me now. So yeah, that was one of my high points was for a brief moment imagining that I am the NB next to that GG. Anyway, yeah, so that was our review of Barbie. But yeah, it's been a great summer for movies. These, even though there haven't been many movies, for the box office, it's been great. Like I said, both Barbie and Oppenheimer should not have made numbers like this.
I think maybe because there have not been so many big films. The few big films have garnered a lot of it.
Even with that, the total box office is higher, closer now to pre-pandemic than it ever was. So it's, and should not be for these kind of movies. It should have been for some other stuff, right? You need a range of movies to allow people to come in. You know, good for the box office, good for people going to the theater. And now we're going to go into a lull as well with the strike, like you mentioned earlier. There's going to be fewer and fewer movies coming out. Things are moving. Dune has moved to next year as well. So Dune won't be around for this year's award cycle or box office. So it should be fun to see what happens now with even with Oscars and all that when we come back. There's not going to be any other big movies that can get in. So it's going to be the smaller movies, the usual Oscar type movies. But every now and then you have one or two or three big movies that go across the board on nominations in terms of, you know, the 10 nominations and all that only comes from larger movies that can touch production and editing and everything else. So it would have been Nolan with Oppenheimer and then probably Dune with special effects and production and this and that. With Dune going, that opens a lot of space for even Barbie. Barbie would have been anyway in on production and music and few of the other things. But I think now Greta gets a voice at the table there as well.
Yeah, indeed.
Anyway.
One thing that really worked for me in this film, but while it worked for me, I thought it was, again, tonally not fitting in with the rest of the film, was the hat tips to other movies, right? The 2001 Space Odyssey opening, I think, was the high point of the film for me, where the girl crashes her old toys, etc. I
even
love
that
the film also
Godfather.
References... Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And which is a very clean bro thing.
Yeah. And the Matrix sort of reference as well. High heel and the flat Birkenstock type sandal offered as the red pill and the blue pill. And the movie also reminded me a lot of Truman Show, Barbie living in a certain universe and trying to break out of it in the end. Again, right at the end of the film, why does she need to go and get a vagina? Right? Like, why is that seen as an accomplishment at that point?
That's not the thing. The thing is, a couple of things. One is claiming femininity. But I think the bigger one,
That's very, very troublesome, right? Having to if what the film is trying to problem. Say.
That's what the film has those issues. I can 100% agree. It cannot, nothing can be everything to everyone. And this struggles when it tries to be a lot of things to most people and then cannot be.
And that's the problem. In this day and age, that's exactly the sort of thing that can get the film itself cancelled because people are just waiting.
But the reason this one works for the people who works, and I'm not the, I don't know that we should be having this concern, and I know I'm not a group, but kind of paraphrase from what Greta said, feminine health is important. People actually don't go to the gynecologist, apparently. Yeah, now this is all like stuff that I have learned. It's hidden even in the US, sex education is still bad and all of that. So simply to just say, if you take nothing else from this movie, at least if you're a woman, go meet the gynecologist, like at least do that. No, hello, it's, hey, look,
that's absolutely correct. But this is a cop out. But that's a cop out from Greta Gerwig. No, she's of course right. I don't think she was going for that though.
And then that's what she said. Something like basically it's an important thing to also say, yes, please go to the gynecologist. Like literally she did add that in one of her interviews. So I'm not in the position to, I don't think we are in a position to figure out the nuances of this thing. But yeah, that's how it ends with her becoming quote unquote human in the real world.
Yeah.
All right. So that was Barbenjelheimer or whatever it was.
Barbenjelheimer.
But yeah, this was good. Good to be back. I hope listeners enjoy it as much as we did. And I think we will have to probably search and find things to do if the strike continues to go on, which it will. But we'll find something.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's always enough content. So we'll find something. Thank you, Nitin.
Yeah. Good stuff. This was fun, Dodi. And I'm also surprised that we finished well on time, despite talking about four films.
Yeah, is it on time? I feel like it's longer, but whatever. It's fine.
Dude, we spent 1.5 hours talking about Black Panther. We spent longer talking about one episode of some show once.
Great.
Yeah.
All right. Listeners, please write, like, rate, review our podcast. Please write to us at yointermission@gmail.com or you can ping us on Twitter at yointermission.
Yeah.
It is
your sorry to have. It has been so long
that I've forgotten
that we don't remember our Twitter handle and email address. But it doesn't matter if you don't send us anything over there. Just keep listening to us.
Yes.
And sorry to have kept you waiting for a long time. Hopefully, we'll be back on the train doing this more frequently starting now.
Yeah. A non-crashing train.
Yeah. Because, Dodi. You and me only have to do it. These new guys, they're not very good. So it has to be us.
All these youngsters, all this AI and all can't do what we are doing much.
Usse nahi ho payega.
Yes. Tumse na ho payega. Correct. All right.
Cool.
Great. Thank you all.
Bye-bye. See you soon. Ciao.